John 1 began by blowing our minds, didn't it? With God's description of Jesus, the Word, who was with God and was God, who was there in the beginning, through whom all things were made, in whom was life, and that life was the light of men. And we read that and we're thinking about the Trinity and the nature of God and creation. And then John goes on, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. And we're thinking about the incarnation, Jesus being fully God and fully man. And it feels like that does our heads in too. I wonder whether you've ever met people who are absolutely gripped by something, really excited by it, convinced it should change the world. The trouble is they're no good at explaining how. You sort of share their excitement because it's infectious. But what does this actually mean for me now, you're asking? And they really struggle to get that across. Big concepts, they're great at them. What it means in the nitty-gritty of everyday life, they're completely lost. Well, the good news is that John, who wrote this gospel, isn't like that. He presents Jesus to us in the most mind-blowing terms. But then even last week we began to see him spelling out what Jesus means for us, how he's the one who can take away our sin, and how he's the source of all spiritual power who sets the Holy Spirit to work in his people. But what does that mean for us, you might be asking? After all, if someone gives you a present, you've still got to open it. If you win the lottery, you've still got to make a phone call. Jesus is offering so much. How do we plug into that? Well, that's what John begins to show us in our passage tonight. It's like he really earths what he's been saying so far, especially in our first point. Jesus demands surrender. Jesus demands surrender. Follow me, he says to Philip, verse 43. Just like those two other disciples had done back in verse 37, when they heard John the Baptist say, "Behold the Lamb of God," they followed Jesus. Now, following Jesus is a phrase, isn't it, that just trips off our tongues these days when we're trying to describe what it is to be a Christian. And so there's a danger we lose sight of exactly what it means. But John the writer helps us with that. First, in that interaction Jesus has with those first two disciples who come to him. Verse 38. Turning round, Jesus saw them following and asked, "What do you want?" They said, "Rabbi," which means teacher, "where are you staying?" "Come," he replied, "and you'll see." So they went and saw where he was staying and spent that day with him. So a rabbi, John tells us, was a teacher. And here's how it worked. You see, when we decide to learn about something these days, what do? We go online, we buy a book, we sign up for some lessons, we apply to a college. Not back then. Back then, you found a person you thought could help you, a rabbi, and then quite simply, you attached yourself to them. And basically, you moved in. I studied architecture for 2 years at university. That felt like quite hard work, 8 or 9 hours a day, so I switched to theology, which was much easier. Way less work. What's the hardest you've ever studied? Maybe revising for some exams that are just around the corner. What was that? 12 hours a day, maybe? 6 or 7 days a week? Felt pretty full on, didn't it? You know what? It was nothing, really. Not compared to having a rabbi back then, because that was 24/7. You were with them, learning from them, every waking hour. If you were a planet, it's like they were the sun for you. Your life revolved around them. "Rabbi," these disciples say to Jesus, "can you be that for us? Where are you staying so we can be with you?" "Come," he replied, "and you'll see." And suddenly their lives changed forever. It's like Jesus became the sun for them. And the next day Jesus sees Philip. "Come on," he says, "you come in too, you follow me as well." And getting on for 2,000 years later, Jesus is still saying the same thing to us today. Whatever else you're orbiting, he's saying, whatever else is at the centre of your life right now, it ought to be me. Yeah, but hang on, Jesus, we might be thinking. Of course, we'll take your views into account and we'll check with you before we go rushing into things. We'd love to have you on board in our lives. That sounds great. But right at the centre, as the one who calls all the shots, we're not so sure. Maybe that's what's holding you back right now from taking the plunge and becoming a Christian. I think that's what held me back for a couple of years, if I'm honest. Not being willing to let Jesus take complete charge. And in a way, it's good if you're thinking like that, because it's a sign that you've understood just how much Jesus is demanding. Total surrender, that you let him rule it all. No no-go areas for him. Every breath you take, every thing you do, every place you go, every relationship you've got, he wants to rule it all. But then remember who we're talking about here. We're talking about the Word, who was with God and was God and through whom all things were made. Think for a moment of the distance between the Earth and the Sun. 93 million miles it is, apparently. Scale that down in your mind to the thickness of a piece of paper. Do you know how far it is on that scale to the next nearest star? A stack of paper 70 feet high. Do you know how wide the Milky Way is on that scale? A stack of papers 310 miles high. And that is just a speck in the universe that we can see. Now, do you really think that the one who made all that, just by telling it to exist, is going to be happy to come into your life to be your assistant or your advisor? Do you think he'll be happy to come on board but keep out of how you use your money or your body, who you go out with, that kind of thing? He is so much greater than we are. And that is the thing, isn't it, that Nathanael suddenly realises. Philip finds in verse 45, "We found the one Moses wrote about in the law and about whom the prophets also wrote. Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph," he tells him. "Nazareth? Can anything good come from there?" Nathanael asks. "Come and see," says Philip. And you can imagine Nathanael, can't you? Right then, if you insist. He's really not expecting much. But then verse 47, "When Jesus saw Nathanael approaching, he said of him, 'Here's a true Israelite in whom there's nothing false.'" "How do you know me?" Nathanael asked. Jesus answered, "I saw you while you were still under the fig tree before Philip called you." Have you ever had that thing where you go to look through one of those peephole things in a door and suddenly realise there's someone just on the other side staring back at you? It's like Nathanael gets that here. He thinks he's on his way to check out Jesus and then suddenly realises it's the other way round. We're not told what Nathanael was doing under the fig tree, but he didn't need reminding, did he? And suddenly he realises this Jesus, he knows too. He knows everything. "Rabbi," he says, "you're the Son of God, the King of Israel." It's one of the unnerving things that can happen when you start to look at Jesus properly. C.S. Lewis describes it brilliantly as being a bit like the moment where children who are playing at burglars suddenly hear a real footstep in the hall and they freeze. And it can be a bit like that, can't it? Being interested in spiritual things, searching for the truth, we're pretty positive about that these days, aren't we? Playing at religion can be great fun. And then suddenly we feel his presence and realise it's not us weighing him up, it's the other way around. It's not really about us wondering whether to take him into our lives or not. It's him wondering whether we'll turn the whole lot over to him. Follow me, he says. Jesus demands surrender. But then, second, he doesn't just demand surrender, he promises something too, total satisfaction. That in him, all our desires are met. Do you see how subtly John the writer gets that across in verse 38? What do you want? Jesus asks these two disciples who he sees following him. See how they answer, Rabbi? Where are you staying? What do you want? What are you after? What are you hoping to get from me? Rabbi, where are you staying? We need to know because we want to stick with you. We're not here because we want something from you and then we can go away again. We're here because we've realized we want you. Someone gave you a bit of time and space and a bit of paper and a pen and asked you just to jot down a list of the things that you most want in life. What would it say? Important things. Things that if you get to the end of your life and you haven't got them, you'll think it's all been a failure. It might take us a bit of time and space and a bit of thought to work out exactly what they are, mightn't it? But most of us, we've got a pretty good idea of what most of those things would be. We want respect and recognition. We want to be loved. And more specifically, perhaps, we want a husband or a wife, a job we enjoy, some promotion maybe. Do you see what John is saying? All those things on your list, imagine you get them all, but you don't have Jesus, you don't follow him. There's going to be a day where suddenly you'll have the sickening realization you set your sights way, way too low. And see what else John is saying. All those things on your list, imagine you don't get a single one of them. You don't even come close to getting hold of them. But you do follow Jesus. Then one day, even if you sometimes struggle to see it now, you'll realize you've not missed out at all. Because everything good you've ever longed for is really found in him. And you can trust Jesus because he's got a plan for your life that might not be the one that you chose, you'd have chosen for yourself, but one day you will look back and you will see why he did it and you will be so pleased that ultimately it was all down to him. Simon Peter's life was never the same again after the day we're told about here. Andrew brought Simon Peter to Jesus. Jesus looked at him and said, "You're Simon, son of John. You'll be called Cephas," which when translated is Peter. Simon, Jesus says, "You thought you were going to spend your days working in and maybe one day taking over your father's fishing business. But I've got different plans for you. From now on, you'll be Peter, which means rock. Because you will be the rock on which I'll build my church." And you know, read about the things that Peter ended up doing for Jesus when he was helping to lead the church in the book of Acts. Do you think he ever dreamed he'd end up like that? No, of course he didn't. Do you think he'd have chosen it if it had been down to him? I doubt it. Do you think he regretted it looking back? The nice comfortable life he'd left behind? Of course not. He was just following his king. And notice too where that ends up. Verse 50, Jesus said to Nathanael, "You believe because I told you, I saw you under the fig tree. You'll see greater things than that." He then added, "I tell you," that's a plural you, that's not just to Nathanael, but to everyone who hears him, "I tell you the truth. You'll see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." I wonder whether you know the story of Jacob in Genesis 28, how one night he had this dream. He saw a ladder that reached right up into the heart of heaven with angels going up and down. And right at the top, God standing there, basically saying, "Jacob, you know that promise I made to Abraham your grandfather and Isaac your dad? That one day I'll undo the effects of sin through them and make them into a great people. and bless them and give them a wonderful place all of their own and bless the whole earth through them. Jacob, that promise is still there, and I'm making it to you. It'll be worked out down your family tree. Do you see what Jesus is saying when he alludes back to that dream? That thing Jacob dreamed of, that promise God had made, that was going to be worked out down Jacob's line, that is what Jesus came to do. To undo the effects of sin, to open heaven to people like us so that God's blessing can come cascading down. You know what Jacob said when he woke up from his dream? Genesis 28 verse 16, surely the Lord is in this place, and I wasn't aware of it. How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. You know what John the writer is saying as he holds up Jesus, the Son of Man, here? Surely the Lord is here. How awesome is this man? None other than the house of God, the place where he dwells, and the gate of heaven. Do you want to know how he's going to do that, says John, then? You want to see these greater things? Read on. And it's worth it, isn't it? We've had that promise because we've been told everything we've ever dreamed of is found in him. We can let Jesus redirect our lives. He's come to open heaven to us and to lift us from this broken world right into the presence, the embrace of God himself. So Jesus demands surrender, he promises satisfaction, and then finally he sends us out. And you can't really miss that here, can you? So we've got two stories, haven't we? Two days in the life of Jesus, where first Andrew and this other disciple start following him, and then the next day Philip does that too. And in each case, what happens next? They tell someone else. Andrew finds Simon and Philip finds Nathanael. We found him, they say. And Simon, he goes to Jesus straight away. Nathanael's not quite so sure. Nazareth, can anything good come from there, he asks. I don't think they had a very high view of Nazareth back then. It was a bit like Slough. I can say that, we used to have a Slough postcode. Nathanael is so sceptical, isn't he? Mocking, even. A bit like some of our friends today. But Philip doesn't give up. Look, why don't you come and see, he says. And so Nathanael does, and his life is never the same again. If you and everyone around you are starving, and then one day you come across an unlimited, inexhaustible supply of food, telling others is the most natural thing in the world. If you and everyone around you are dying of some plague, and then one day you find a doctor who's got a cure, telling others would be the most natural thing in the world. You wouldn't even think about it. If we and everyone around us have rejected God and we're stumbling around in the dark under his judgment, and then one day we come across Jesus, God himself, become a man to take away our sins and make us God's children again, then telling others is the most natural thing in the world, isn't it? I recently read a wonderful book about a man called Stephen Lungu, who years ago was involved in a very nasty gang in Zimbabwe. And one night he and some others were sent to bomb a big Christian meeting. But they decided just to listen to what was being said for a few minutes before they threw their bombs. And he heard someone talking about Jesus, and that was it. That night he followed him. But the best thing is what happened the next day. So Stephen Lungu didn't have a job. Previously he just hung around causing trouble. But he desperately wanted to tell people about this Jesus he'd met the night before, so he thought and decided, well, the best place he could find some people, a group of people to talk to, would be on a bus. So he bought a ticket, got on a bus, and started telling his fellow passengers. And maybe it's an African thing, but some of them listened to him. even asked him questions, although he didn't really know the answers to many of them, because he just had this short conversation with an evangelist the night before. But he knew that in Jesus he found the one. And so telling others was the most natural thing in the world. But we can't make other people believe in him, can we? And we can't force them to. We mustn't try to do that. But we can do what Andrew and Philip do, can't we? We found him. Why don't you come and see? Those words can change someone's life. For most of us, the reason we're here this evening is that someone once said something like that to us. Maybe even someone else who's here. Jesus demands surrender, he promises satisfaction, and he sends us out. Andrew went to his brother, Philip went to one of his friends. Who could you go to? We long to be a church that obeys Jesus by telling other people about him. That's partly why we run events, to give people the chance to come and hear about him. And we've got some coming up that we're going to be hearing about in the next few weeks. But events on their own are normally useless. The engine room of growing the church under God, especially in a cynical, apathetic society like ours, is us, quietly, unspectacularly, telling people we know, family, friends, colleagues, course mates. Found him. Why don't you come and see? Who could you go to? Who could you be praying for a chance to speak to?